Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, to better understand the current Israeli-Palestinian crisis, we look at some of the ancient and recent history of Jerusalem and its holy sites. We talk with religion scholar Karen Armstrong, author of Jerusalem, One City, Three Faiths, and the bestseller, A History of God. Also, satirist Christopher Buckley talks about the presidential campaign and why he's voting for George W. Bush. Yesterday, we heard from satirists voting for Gore and for Nader. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us what he thinks is Steve Allen's greatest legacy. Allen died on Monday at the age of 78. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Both Democratic presidential nominee Al Gore and his running mate Joe Lieberman have been campaigning in the crucial state of Florida today. Gore said that George W. Bush is trying to use some fuzzy math of his own to disguise serious flaws with his plan to privatize portions of Social Security. And Gore cited a study by the nonpartisan American Academy of Actuaries to back up his claim that the Bush plan would threaten Social Security. But in Minnesota, Bush said his Social Security proposal gives people a stake in their future. NPR's David Wellna has more from Minneapolis.
As he tried to win over this state that's voted Democratic in every presidential race since the re-election of Richard Nixon, Bush mocked Gore's claim to have shrunk the size of government, and he portrayed the vice president as being out of touch with the mainstream.
And when others, Republican and Democrat, proposed needed reforms in Social Security or Medicare or education, he opposes and attacks and tears them down. Just when progress on important issues seems within reach, he's left the vital center of American politics.
Bush also accused his opponent of waging class warfare for having condemned Bush's tax cuts as primarily benefiting the wealthy. David Wellna, NPR News, Minneapolis.
The General Assembly of the United Nations has voted by acclamation to admit Yugoslavia as a new UN member. The old Yugoslav Federation was a founding member of the UN until the Federation's breakup in 1992. The way was cleared for today's vote when Slobodan Milosevic was voted out as president last month. Three Israeli soldiers and at least five Palestinians were killed today in clashes in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The Israeli troops were the first killed in a month, prompting Prime Minister Ehud Barak to say that his country will not tolerate what he called grave escalation of the situation. Israel's Foreign Minister Shlomo Ben-Ami is in Washington meeting with administration officials, as NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Ben-Ami's schedule includes meetings with Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and National Security Advisor Sandy Berger. Immediately after Ben-Ami's meetings, a top Palestinian negotiator, Saeb Erekat, comes to Washington for similar discussions. There are no plans for Erekat and Ben-Ami to meet each other. American mediators are pressing both sides to keep the commitments they made in President Clinton's presence at an emergency summit in Egypt last month. Commitments to end the violence and to ease restrictions on the movement of people and goods. This, according to State Department spokesman Richard Boucher. Ending the violence is our highest priority, Boucher said, adding, once that's been achieved, we can focus on restoring confidence in the peace process and finding a way back to the negotiating table. Ted Clark, NPR News, Washington.
Wall Street today, the Dow lost 71 points in active trading. The Nasdaq was down 36. This is NPR News. President Clinton has signed legislation that could send auto industry executives to prison for up to 15 years for deliberately withholding information about harmful products. The bill was prompted by Bridgestone Firestone's recall of 6.5 million tires. Authorities in Utah say a 2-year-old boy who was lost in the woods last week died of hypothermia. The boy disappeared from his father's truck last Thursday, and apparently he froze to death. The Chicago City Council has approved a measure that requires the Pledge of Allegiance to be said before each of the City Council meetings, despite a threat of opposition from African American council members. From Chicago Public Radio, Robbie Harris has more.
A group of African American Chicago City Council members had objected to the measure requiring the pledge before every meeting, saying the nation hasn't embraced the pledge's final phrase, liberty and justice for all. but the unanimous vote in favor of the pledge supports Alderman Dorothy Tillman's position that the issue is trivial compared to others that face African Americans.
I want us to vote for it and get it out of the way because I don't want this in the way of reparations.
In May, the Chicago City Council voted to urge Congress to study the idea of reparations for slavery as a way to address past injustices some aldermen say continue to affect African Americans. For NPR News, I'm Robbie Harris in Chicago.
The government is recalling about 500 million horizontal window blinds because of strangulation deaths among children. The Consumer Product Safety Commission says 130 deaths have been caused by window blind cords with loops at the end in the past decade. The blinds don't have to be returned or even taken down to be fixed. The commission is making free repair kits available. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's impossible to understand the current crisis between Israelis and Palestinians without a grasp of history. Today we're going to examine one chapter in the complicated history of the region, the Old City of Jerusalem and its holy sites. Jurisdiction over these sites remains one of the contested issues between Israelis and Palestinians. In fact, one of the incidents that led to the current crisis was when Ariel Sharon, the Israeli hardliner and former defense minister, asserted Jewish claims to the Temple Mount, a Jewish holy site that is also a Muslim holy site known as Haram al-Sharif. My guest Karen Armstrong is a scholar of the world's religions. She's the author of Jerusalem, One City, Three Faiths, as well as the bestseller, A History of God. Her latest book is called Islam, A Short History. She's a former nun. I asked Armstrong to describe the importance of the Temple Mount and Haram al-Sharif to the Jews and Muslims who worship there.
The Temple Mount is the holiest place in the Jewish world, and everyday worshippers will go there. People who live in Jerusalem will pray there at the Western Wall, the last link with Herod's Temple. They'll also celebrate marriage there. They'll celebrate the bar mitzvah of their sons. And it's the hub of Jewish religious life in Jerusalem. But up above it, you have the Haram al-Sharif, the third holiest shrine in the Muslim world. And there you have every Friday, the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the surrounding countryside will gather for the Friday prayers to hear a sermon and to pray together as a community. They'll visit the Dome of the Rock, the oldest great building in the Muslim world, the site of the Prophet Muhammad's ascension to heaven. And that is a site of pilgrimage for Muslims all over the world. And that's very much the hub of Muslim religious life in Jerusalem. Muslims will gather there to pray together, to discuss, to study. It's the center of their religious lives in Jerusalem.
Let's go back to the origins of the Jewish temple. When was it first built?
Well, the Bible tells us that King Solomon built a temple around about 950 BC. And this was the temple to his god, Yahweh. And it was a shrine of great importance to the people of Israel. His father, King David, had conquered the city from the inhabitants, the Jebusites, some 50 years earlier. And now Jerusalem was brought into the Israelite religious world, and it became gradually, over the centuries, a very important shrine for the people of Israel.
And how was it destroyed?
Well, it was destroyed a couple of times. It was destroyed in 586 by King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, in the course of hostilities against the people of Judah. And then the Jews later rebuilt their temple, and eventually that one was destroyed by the Romans in the Jewish revolt against Rome in the year 70. Jews mourned the loss of that temple, but created a new form, new ways of being Jewish.
Now, how did this area become both an Islamic holy site and a Jewish holy site?
Well, the Muslims, when had always venerated Jerusalem. As soon as the Prophet Muhammad began to preach in Mecca in the year 610, he made his followers bow down in worship several times a day, facing Jerusalem, in the direction of Jerusalem. It was their way of turning their backs on the pagan traditions of Mecca and reaching out to the God of the Jews and the Christians, whom they were now going to worship. Islam, especially at the beginning, did not regard itself as a new faith. Muhammad simply felt that he was bringing the old faith of the Jews and the Christians, the one God, to the people of Arabia, who'd never had a prophet before and had never had a scripture in their own language. And so the Quran venerates all the great prophets of the Jewish Christian past. And the Quran remembers with great piety the story of Solomon, the prophet Solomon, who built a temple in Jerusalem. And so when the Muslims arrived in Jerusalem and conquered the city in the year 638, they immediately made a beeline for the Temple Mount, and there they established themselves on the site of the great prophets of the past. As well as celebrating the Prophet Muhammad and his mystical journey to heaven on the Temple Mount, they also venerate Solomon and King David and Jesus, who plays a very important role in the Islamic devotion to Jerusalem.
What shape was the temple in when the Muslims took over that area and rebuilt the temple?
Well, the Christians, who had been in charge of the city, had left the Temple Mount in a state of ruin. It was a mark of disrespect to Judaism. The place was piled high with rubble and fallen masonry. And in recent years, shortly before the Muslim conquest, the Christians had taken to using the site as the city garbage dump. And so it was piled high with stinking garbage and rubbish. And the caliph and his entourage were absolutely horrified when they arrived on the Temple Mount and saw this scene of absolute desolation. And immediately the caliph began to take stones and rubbish into his cloak and then hurl it over the parapets, clearing the site. So the Muslims consecrated the site and built, first of all, a very simple little mosque at the southern end of the platform. And that's the site on which the mosque known as Al-Aqsa stands today. Later, in the year 691, they built the famous Dome of the Rock, which is the shrine with the great golden dome that's so famous and so clearly associated with Jerusalem today.
When the Muslims reconsecrated the area that had been the Jewish temple, did they welcome Jews to that area to pray?
Yes, indeed. The Christians had never permitted Jews to reside permanently in the city. But the caliph and the Muslims brought Jews back. 70 families from Tiberias, up in the north of Israel, were brought back into Jerusalem, and they settled down. And Jews, they didn't want to build a temple of their own, of course, on the Temple Mount. The rabbis had told them that only the Messiah could build a third temple. That would be at the end of days. It wasn't for mere men to do that. But they really celebrated the reconsecration of the site by the Muslims. And there are texts in the 7th century which show Jews welcoming the Muslims and celebrating them as the precursors of the Messiah for this act of piety in rededicating their holy site.
How long did these good feelings between Jews and Muslims last in Jerusalem?
Good feelings between Jews and Muslims lasted a very, very long time, up to the beginning of the 20th century. There was tension between the Muslims and the Christians, especially after the Crusades. The Crusades marked a real the real nadir of life in Jerusalem. It was a horrible, devastating attack by the Western Christians of Europe, and many, many Jews and Muslims died in Jerusalem as the victims of the Crusaders. But relations between Judaism and Islam in the Middle East and in Jerusalem were generally good, that's why the present conflict is so particularly tragic.
My guest is religion scholar Karen Armstrong. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're talking about some of the ancient history that might help us understand the current events in the Middle East and the crisis between Israel and the Palestinians. My guest is a scholar of religion, Karen Armstrong, whose books include Jerusalem and Islam, A Short History. She's also written about the history of fundamentalism around the world. Let's jump ahead to more contemporary history, more recent history. The British captured Jerusalem in 1917, thank you.
Yes.
Why did the Brits want that part of the world? What were they doing there?
Oh, well, the British at that time were fighting World War One, and one of the enemies that they were fighting in World One was the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire, which had sided with Germany. And so they were invading the lands of the Ottoman Empire right across the Middle East, Syria, Palestine, Lebanon, and Egypt, where they were already had a military occupation. But of course, once the war was over, the British did not go home. It was part of their colonial mentality. Britain at that stage felt that it should rule the waves, and Britain and France in 1920 virtually carved up the Middle East between them and established protectorates there. They felt that they were a civilizing force in the region, but this was, of course, much resented by the Arab peoples of the area who'd all hoped for independence once the Ottoman Empire had been defeated.
And how did the Zionists establish a foothold in that area during the British mandate?
Well, in 1917, the British government issued what's known as the Balfour Declaration, which gave British support to the idea of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. And so while the British were in charge in Jerusalem and in Palestine, they were supporting the idea of a Jewish state or a Jewish homeland, though there was much debate about how that was going to be implemented. But I'm afraid, and this saddens me to say this, the British behaviour was not good in Jerusalem. I mean, in a sense, as colonialists, they tended to despise both sides, treated both sides with a certain amount of contempt. And it's very marked when you go to Jerusalem as a Brit today that the hostility is still there on both sides, but neither the Jewish side nor the Palestinian side have much good to say about our rule in Jerusalem, which was racist and colonial and imperialistic.
And do you think that imperialistic British rule helped set the tone for what happened later?
Well, it was a very ugly struggle because it was one thing for the British government to say, oh, yes, by all means, let's have a Jewish state in Palestine or a Jewish homeland in Palestine. But then when they were actually there and saw that the place was filled with Palestinian inhabitants, then they realised that it wasn't quite so easy to implement this. And so they adopted all kinds of policies, blocking immigration, even shamefully, during the time when Jews were trying to escape from Nazi Germany before the Holocaust. So there was bad feeling there. The Arabs naturally naturally distrusted and hated the British for giving away their land. But I think basically what you just had was a clash of two peoples who both felt that they had a claim to the land. And that clash is still not resolved today.
Let's jump ahead to 1947, the UN partition. What happened to Jerusalem in 1947?
Well, in the UN plan, the idea was that Palestine should be divided between the Palestinians and the Israelis, but that Jerusalem should be a separate body, a separate entity ruled by the international community. It should be an international zone. But that plan fell by the wayside when, during the war between the new Jewish state and the invading Arab armies in 1948, in the course of which Jordan invaded East Jerusalem and Israel invaded and captured West Jerusalem, and between them, Jordan and Israel divided the city between them in a partition. It was a very ugly state of affairs. There was barbed wire dividing the two sectors of the city. Jews were not allowed to visit the Western Wall, which was in the Jordanian side, and they complained that the bad feeling following the Palestinian loss of their homeland, they claimed that holy synagogues in the old city of Jerusalem were desecrated by the Palestinians. And similarly, Palestinians complained that many of their homes in West Jerusalem had been purloined by the Israelis. So you have the beginnings of the conflict about Jerusalem, about who owns it and what should be done with it.
I'm going to jump ahead again now to 1967 at the end of the Six-Day War. How has the status of Jerusalem changed by that?
Well, during the Six-Day War in 1967, Israel achieved a stunning victory over the invading armies and entered and occupied East Jerusalem. And Jerusalem, they said, was now united again after this period of partition. And it was a great and sort of emotional moment because Jews were able to visit the Western Wall again. And there were huge scenes of rejoicing. People who had no religious beliefs, generals like Moshe Dayan, who was not a religious man at all, had tears pouring down their faces. It was a huge thing. Largely, I think, because the Jews recognised the Western Wall as being rather like themselves, a survivor. It was linked with tradition, with some of the most sacred traditions of their past, but it was a survivor, just as they had survived some of them had survived the terrible events in Europe during World War II. The Western Wall, had survived nearly 2,000 years of bloody and turbulent history in Jerusalem. And it was an immensely important and moving moment. And from that moment, too, a new religious element entered the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Because of the holy sites. And there was, too, a religious revival on both sides of the conflict. There was a religious revival within Israel, and religious parties came more and more to the fore. A religious a form of Zionism was established. Zionism had begun as a secularist movement, almost as a revolution against religious Judaism. But now, in the new religious climate after 1967, there was a sort of a new form of religious Zionist fundamentalism. On the Muslim side, not just on the Palestinian side, but in countries such as Egypt, Jordan, there was also a religious revival. People felt that the ideologies of socialism and nationalism, which had been imported by the West, had been discredited. The Arabs had lost, suffered a shameful defeat. They seemed unable to make any any headway against Israel, and people turned back to religion. They said, let's go back to the time before the West invaded our lands with all these new ideas like nationalism and socialism. Let's go back to Islam, which is our back to our roots. And so from that time, a religious dimension has entered the conflict, which makes it all much more difficult to sort out. When there are simply secularist ideals, then people can feel free to make concessions, to make compromises. But when something is regarded as sacred, as absolutely essential and central to a people's identity, then it becomes much more difficult. And Jerusalem has become, for both sides of the conflict, a symbol of that sacred identity. And no compromise at the moment seems to be possible.
Now, you mentioned that Zionism started as a secular movement, and you quote Theodor Herzl, one of the fathers of Zionism, as saying in 1898, when he first visited Jerusalem, that he deplored the city's, quote, musty deposits of 2,000 years of inhumanity, intolerance, and foulness. And you say his first impulse was to tear down the old city. He was just so wanted to distance himself and Zionism from the warring over it.
Well, Herzl was a secularist, and he had very little, I think, understanding of religion. He quite rightly saw, he sensed that there was going to be an impending anti-Semitic disaster in Europe. He sensed the coming Holocaust and felt that it was essential that Jews had a place of refuge. But as for the holy aspects of Jerusalem, he wasn't interested in that at all. Many of the Zionists hated watching Jews praying at the Western Wall. They hated watching these rabbis with long beards and archaic clothes clutching at these holy stones and kissing them and weeping. They said, this is an image of the old Jew. This is an image of the defeated, craven Jew. This is the image of everything we want Zionism to transcend. We want to create a new, proud, secular Jew. And so Herzl, when he saw all this, he said, oh, let's get rid of it. But then the next day in his diary, he changed his mind and he wrote down that he decided, let's put all the shrines in the old city, put them in a sort of separate cordon sanitaire. Let's make them into a sort of museum. And let's build outside the walls a new Zionist, modern, fresh, tolerant, bright and airy city, and get rid of the past, because we're branching out towards something new. So that was the very much the spirit. The Zionists were willing, right up to 1947, 1948, to make concessions about Jerusalem. What their priority was, getting a Jewish state working and a viable entity. Jerusalem was something that, you know, that they were willing to share it, divide it with Jordan. They agreed to the United Nations plan to make it an international zone in 1947, because the priority was to get a Jewish state, especially after World War II, when so many Jews had died in Europe. And had there been a Jewish state, perhaps they need not have died.
Karen Armstrong is the author of Jerusalem, One City, Three Faiths, and A History of God. Her latest book is called Islam, A Short History. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble. Booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications. BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Harmony Books Division, publishers of Mom's Marijuana, a memoir by NPR contributor Dan Shapiro. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Jerusalem as it's divided now. We continue our discussion with religion scholar Karen Armstrong. Conservative satirist Christopher Buckley gives us his take on the election, and TV critic David Bianculli tells us what he thinks is Steve Allen's greatest legacy. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with religion scholar Karen Armstrong. To better understand the current Israeli-Palestinian crisis, we're examining some of the ancient and recent history of Jerusalem and its holy sites. Armstrong is the author of Jerusalem, One City, Three Faiths, and the bestseller A History of God. How is Jerusalem divided now?
Well, of course, the city is technically united under Israeli sovereignty. But there are areas in East Jerusalem where Jews don't feel comfortable about going because these are Arab sectors, the Arab neighborhoods. And especially in times of political crisis, tension runs high in these areas. And similarly, many Palestinians don't feel at all comfortable about going into West Jerusalem, which is predominantly an Israeli zone. And there are very, so you have, in a sense, a city that is technically at one, but still there are lines of demarcation. There are also the Israeli government and has established settlements in Arab East Jerusalem, there are new Jewish neighbourhoods in what Arabs feel is their land, is their part of Jerusalem, and that is also the source of a great deal of tension.
What do the Palestinians want now for Jerusalem?
They want a share in sovereignty. Then they are not, except for their extreme hotheads, they are not claiming sole sovereignty over the entire city. But they do want a sovereignty in part of the city. They want to share the city in a sort of an official way with the Israelis. The Israelis, however, say that Jerusalem is the eternal and indivisible capital of the state of Israel and say they must have sole sovereignty. So there is a tension here. Of course, Jerusalem has always become, in its past, more sacred and more important to a people after they've lost it. You see that phenomenon happening again and again throughout the long, troubled history of Jerusalem. When a people have been exiled from Jerusalem, have lost sovereignty of the city, they return and they say, we'll never leave this city again, and it becomes precious to them. Now, we have the Israelis, Jewish people now again in charge of Jerusalem for the first time for nearly 2,000 years, after periods of tremendous suffering in Jewish life. Some see the Jewish Jerusalem as arising like a phoenix out of the ashes of Auschwitz. It's seen as it's one way in which the Jewish people feel that they can perhaps begin to come to terms with the Holocaust. But on the other hand, the Palestinians watch the city slipping daily from their grasp, and they feel more passionate about it than ever. They see the city, surrounded as it is by these big, powerful Jewish neighbourhoods, as a symbol of their own beleaguered identity. Both of them, you have a clash here of two people who have either just returned to Jerusalem or feel that they are losing it, and are both feeling more passionate about it than ever. So, you know, that makes the whole thing very inflammatory and very sensitive. And holy sites are likely to be particular flashpoints.
Now, you are a scholar of the religions of the world, and you worship in all three of the monotheistic religions. You go to churches, you go to mosques, you go to synagogues. As somebody who embraces all three faiths, and I should mention here that you used to be a nun, that you were brought up Catholic, do you feel like you empathize with both the Israelis and the Palestinians?
Yes, I can see both where they're coming from. I really can. I can see that after the Holocaust, the Jewish people is still profoundly wounded, and its attachment to Jerusalem is understandable. But I can also understand the Palestinians who have always loved Jerusalem, who the Muslim world looked after Jerusalem and allowed Jews always to come and live in the city when they were in charge of it. I sympathise with them too, because it's not just the holy site. sites or the holiness of the city. Jerusalem is the home of Palestinians. Their families have lived in the city for generations. They feel about Jerusalem, apart from its being a holy city, as we all feel about our hometowns. There is an attachment there to people who've both been wounded in very different ways and to different degrees, but have been wounded. I hate seeing this bloodshed, which I see as tragic for both sides. Tragic for the Palestinians. Most of the loss of life has been Palestinian. But I also grieve for the Israeli army, which was a magnificent achievement, and which is, in a sense, almost, I feel, wounding itself by gunning down children and civilians. This is a terrible, terrible situation, and I feel really quite torn by watching this. My own religious journey was strongly shaped by Jerusalem. I was sick and tired of religion when I first visited Jerusalem in 1983. But it was the vision of these three faiths living together, however uneasily, in this holy city, which made me profoundly aware of the interconnection, the link between these three religions of Abraham. And from that time on, I've always tried to devote myself to presenting the three viewpoints simultaneously, seeing them as the same religious family. And of course, and it is tragic now, after it gave me that plural vision, to see the city as so often in its turbulent history, a city not of peace, but a city of bloodshed and war.
One of the things you say in your book, Jerusalem, is that the history of Jerusalem proves that suffering doesn't necessarily make us better, nobler people.
That, I think, is again true, and you see it on both sides of the conflict. It's a sort of myth, isn't it, that when we've suffered, we'll become wiser and more sympathetic and be able to empathise with the suffering of others. But it doesn't. It's very often the bully, perhaps child who's been bullied in the playground, learns to bully other people. And on both sides, the Israelis who have the triumph, and they are powerful and have achieved enormous power and success in the state of Israel, but that sometimes they seem to be acting in a way that's disproportionate to the violence offered to them. And the Palestinians, sometimes the sort of ugliness of defeat, the corrosive effect of prolonged defeat on the spirit, is also terrible. And I sympathise with them, because nobody cares about the Palestinians, not we in the West, not their own Arab neighbours. And I think they feel this, and hence this, the awful, nihilistic and dreadful prospect of more suicide bombings. I can't imagine an expression of greater despair and hopelessness than that.
Would you want to go to Jerusalem now?
Oh, yes. In fact, I was scheduled to be going to Jerusalem in December for a conference on the future of the city. Goodness knows whether that conference will be cancelled in the light of the present crisis. Probably it will. But no, it's not just a holiday place. I think if you really love a city, then you have to be there in its hard times as well as in its happier times.
Karen Armstrong is the author of Jerusalem, One City, Three Faiths, and the bestseller A History of God. Her latest book is called Islam, A Short History. Coming up, satirist Christopher Buckley on the presidential campaign. This is Fresh Air. Yesterday on Fresh Air, we talked with two satirists about the presidential campaign, Al Franken, who's writing for the Al Gore campaign, and Bill Maher, who's voting for Ralph Nader. This morning, I spoke with conservative satirist Christopher Buckley. He's voting for George W. Bush. Buckley is the author of the novels Little Green Men and Thank You for Smoking, and he's the editor of Forbes FYI magazine. Let me say that we had a harder time finding conservative comics and satirists than Democratic ones, and I'm wondering if you have any guesses about why that's true.
Well, my guess is that might-be Republican satirists went into fields that compensate a little better than this one. There was a piece in the New York Times Sunday Magazine some weeks ago about political humor. It's focused in on the staffs of the people who work for Jay Leno and David Letterman and I think Jon Stewart. And it was interesting how uniformly liberal and left-wing they all were. While I caught a note here or two of sort of self-congratulation on their part for for daring to hold these beliefs, which struck me as sort of funny given the homogeneity, the political homogeneity within the the joke writing crowd. It tends to be, I would say, 99% liberal. So that may be one reason why you had a hard time tracking down a so-called conservative pundit. But there are some brilliant ones, much better than myself. P.J. O'Rourke is surely the funniest, or at least for my money, the funniest political writer around, and he's very right wing. Maybe you should have called him.
May I say that we did call him?
Oh, you did call him?
Yes, we called you both.
Well, what was his excuse?
We called you both. Well, you called back and he didn't.
That makes me sound rather desperate, I'm afraid.
No, he might have been out of the country.
He was probably out of the
knows?
Country. Maybe he was drilling for oil in the Arctic preserve, getting a head start on George Bush.
Let me get to the presidential campaign.
Sure.
I was talking to a foreign journalist the other day, and he said, I can't believe that you Americans might really elect someone so stupid as George W. Bush to be president. What would you have said to him?
Well, foreign journalists generally have a sort of a disdainful view of our politics. On that one, I would say that, politicians get pigeonholed into their sort of comic personas. Al Gore got typed early on as the stiff guy, and Bush got tagged as a dumb guy because he's not much of a book reader and he can't pronounce words. Bush, I think, has managed to neutralize that a little bit by the good old ploy of making fun of yourself. But I don't think George W. Bush is a second Dan Quayle, despite the attempts to make him into one. You know, Al Gore is obviously a better student. I mean, Al Gore is the guy who in high school would have raised his hand and reminded the teacher that she had forgotten to hand out the homework assignment.
Wait, you're the second person I heard say that.
Really?
Yeah, well, someone on the Ima show said the same thing.
Oh, is that right? Well,
yeah.
Well, either great minds think alike or I'm a plagiarist. No, I don't claim that's an original insight, but I think it's one worth repeating. Bush is the guy who shows up 5 minutes before the test, not having cracked a book, and asks whether or not this is the chemistry test or the history test. I leave it to you, to decide which one is funnier. I think as a satirist or someone who sort of writes about these people, I'm frankly torn as to who to be for this time around. I mean, in terms of who's going to be a funnier target for the next 4 years, I suspect that all these the liberal writers on the Leno and the Letterman and the other shows are secretly hoping for a Bush victory because he's going to be putty in their hands. It's going to be 4 years of Quayle 2. You can make fun of Gore, but Gore, I think, is a more he's a more serious guy, obviously. And the humor that about Gore is going to have to go deeper because you're making fun. You're going to end up satirizing his such things as his inability, his apparent inability to tell the truth. Now that's perforce nastier a nastier kind of humor than making subliminal bubble jokes.
Now, I want to get back to your comment about Al Gore being the equivalent of the smart kid in class who'd raise his hand and say, but teacher, you forgot to give us homework. Why are people against Gore so concerned that he's too smart, that he's like the smart kid in class? Why is that perceived as a problem? Why wouldn't you want the president to be smart?
Well, you know, if IQ were the ultimate determinant of success in the Oval Office, Jimmy Carter would have been our most successful president. I mean, Jimmy Carter was, as he would describe himself, a nuclear engineer. And you know who the second brightest guy probably was? Richard Nixon. Now, neither of those two presidencies, I put it to you, ended in spectacular success. A very wise man once said that he would rather be ruled by the first 2,000 names in the Boston telephone book than by the faculty of Harvard.
So
I think with Gore, you would get the faculty of Harvard. With Bush, you get the first 2,000 names in the Boston phone book.
But you're a smart guy. Your father, William Buckley, is a smart guy.
And he's the guy who said that. I'm obviously aiming for an increase in my allowance.
So you're really arguing against voting
for a
smart guy?
No. If you reduce it to that, it sounds silly. I mean, the bumper sticker becomes vote for the dumb guy. You know, he'll be the best. No, I'm saying that IQ alone, smartness alone, is not the only qualification. I mean, David Halberstam wrote a brilliant book about this called The Best and the Brightest, which was about all the smart Harvard guys who got us into a long, tragic war in Vietnam. All of them were bright guys.
Yesterday on our show, we heard from satirist Al Franken, who's actually writing some material for Gore and working for the Gore campaign. And we heard from satirist Bill Maher, who says he would never write for a candidate. What about you? Have you ever or would you ever write for a candidate?
Well, I wrote for George Bush's father. I was his speechwriter for 2 years in 1981 to 1983 when he was vice president. I'm not now, nor have I been writing material for George Bush.
You didn't come up with subliminal?
I wish I had. I really wish I had. They called me about a year ago and asked me, but I was in a slightly awkward position because I edit a magazine at Forbes, and as you know, my capo di tutti copy, Steve Forbes, was then running, so I said, well, I kind of can't do that, but he's got talented people. I would like to actually reveal who's writing George W.'s humor, and it's our old friend Ray Siller. When I heard this a week ago, I was amazed because Ray Siller. It was to Ray Siller that I used to turn when I was in the White House in 1981 to 83 for the jokes. He was then Johnny Carson's chief writer, and he liked Bush. He liked Bush's father, and he had volunteered his services. So I would call poor Ray Siller, and because there was a call from the White House, he would always take it, even if he was in a meeting with Johnny Carson. I always felt moderately embarrassed about that. And I would say to poor Ray Siller, Ray, he's speaking to the National Association of Realtors tomorrow. Do you have any realtor jokes? And I would hear this sigh on the other end. He'd say, well, I'll call you back. And, you know, the next day Bush would be about to go on 5,000 realtors in Miami, Florida, whatever. And a WACA guy, White House communications guy, would come up with one of those heavy, clunky portable phones and say, some guy named Ray Siller for you. And Ray would, I would sit there taking dictation on index cards from Ray and do a quick humor triage of the funniest jokes and hand them to George Bush before he went on. So I was sort of thrilled to hear that he's still doing that 20 years later.
Do you have any favorite lines that you wrote for President Bush?
No, my I didn't write read my lips or any particularly I don't think memorable lines, but we had some there were some good moments. It was, you know, the lines don't survive, but they were, you know, they were, some of them were not bad. There were some there were a couple of flubs when I those always end up being the most memorable ones. One time I put a quote from the historian Thucydides in the speech, and it he got to that word and it he got kind of tongue tied, poor guy, and it he went ooh, and it went on for about 15 seconds, and I was sitting at the staff table opposite Admiral Murphy, the 4-star admiral who was the chief of staff. And you know, I went to a Catholic school, and I thought I knew strict, but I'd never worked for a 4-star admiral before. They're really strict. And he started glaring at me, and I looked at the admiral, saying, "Wait, I didn't make up this word." And anyway, finally Bush got it out, "Cididies," and Admiral Murphy came up to me afterwards and poked me in the sternum and said, "Next time, say Plato."
What are you going to be doing on election night?
I'm going to be sitting at home with this TV that I bought that I still can't figure out how to use. But if you figure out how to use it, it will split the screen so that you can see what, you know, one network is doing and then flick to the other. But I have a week to get through this 200-page instruction manual. So if I do, I will be sitting at home watching my new split-screen TV. And I think it's going to be an exciting night. I think it's going to be a late night.
Well, I hope you don't have to learn how to program your VCR in the next week, too, because then you're really going to be in trouble.
That's hopeless. I read some years ago that William Shatner, Captain Kirk of the Starship Enterprise, could not program his VCR, and I was delighted.
Well, Christopher Buckley, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Christopher Buckley's latest novel is Little Green Men. He's the editor of the magazine Forbes FYI. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli remembers Steve Allen. This is Fresh Air. Steve Allen died Monday at the age of 78. He was a composer, author, and entertainer. But for TV critic David Bianculli, his greatest legacy is in the arena of the late-night talk show, which Allen personally pioneered.
In the late 1940s, Steve Allen made his mark as the host of a late-night radio show, a show so freewheeling and so popular that eventually it was broadcast from a special studio that seated 800 people. Instead of playing records, he chatted with guests, took his microphone into the audience, and generally goofed around. In December 1950, he got his first shot at a TV series, a New York experiment that eventually grew into a late-night show that NBC wanted to expand and broadcast nationally. In 1954, that show, retitled Tonight, was launched as television's first national late-night talk show. 90 minutes a night, all of it live, and very little of it planned. Here's how Allen opened that very first program.
Now to meet the star of our show, Steve Allen.
Anyway, in case you're just joining us, this is Tonight. And I can't think of too much to tell you about it, except I want to give you the bad news first. This program is going to go on forever. Boy, you think you're tired now. Wait till you see 1 o'clock roll around.
Allen was right, you know. The Tonight Show has gone on forever. Hosted first by him, then by Jack Parr, then Johnny Carson, and currently by Jay Leno. Meanwhile, Steve Allen fans like Dave Letterman have absorbed his comic sensibility into their own shows. With his Tonight Show, Allen provided the basic blueprint for all subsequent talk shows. Opening monologue, band leader and band, desk and guest chairs, a mixture of performance and casual talk. But rather than be stifled by the format, Allen ran wild with it. In one of his most famous stunts from the early days, Allen was annoyed by a studio audience he thought was particularly unresponsive. So right in the middle of his live show, he led them in a conga line, steered them through the studio doors, re-entered first and locked those doors behind them, then finished the show with just the stage crew. Allen pointed his cameras outside the studio doors to catch real New York and real New Yorkers. And in addition to those real people, he had his talented improvisational core of regulars, who got even more exposure when Allen quit The Tonight Show to focus on his primetime variety series. Don Knotts, Tom Poston, Louie Nye, Bill Dana, Pat Harrington Jr., bandleader Skitch Henderson, all of them worked through such bits as Man on the Street, Stump the Band, the prankish funny phone calls, Allen's Answer Man, the solemn reading of inane rock lyrics, the news spoofs, and the reading of actual angry letters printed in the New York Daily News. Allen jumped into a vat of Jell-O, turned himself into a human teabag, and often made audiences laugh simply by releasing his own genuine torrents of uncontrollable giggles. His guest roster ranged from Carl Sandburg to Lenny Bruce, from Coleman Hawkins to the Three Stooges. The Muppets got their first exposure on Allen's show, and Elvis Presley got a famously self-deprecating one, wearing top hat and tails to sing Hound Dog to a real hound dog. 3 years after Leno inherited The Tonight Show, he told Newsweek magazine, "I think we all borrowed from Steve Allen." Before Letterman even got his late-night show, he identified Steve Allen as one of his two comedy idols. The other was Johnny Carson, who, like Leno and Letterman, borrowed liberally from what Allen did all those years ago. He really was one of the originals.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. We'll close with Steve Allen at the piano, recorded in 1992. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated's Delacorte Books Division, publisher of Sometimes I Dream in Italian by Rita Cerisi, a new novel by the author of Pink Slip. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Delacorte Press Division, publisher of The Colewood Way, a memoir, new from Homer Hickam, author of October Sky. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Alan Cumming. He starred in the recent revival of Cabaret and co-starred in the films Eyes Wide Shut, Get Carter, GoldenEye, and Urbania. Also, we talk with actress Anna Deavere Smith. She's written a new memoir. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.